gibberish? Lindsay interrupted, incredulous. Colin ignored her, responding in English to Hassan. It's not doodling, which you'd know if you...
Went to college, right. God, so predictable, Hassan said.
Then he turned to Lindsay and said,
We are not speaking gibberish. We're speaking the sacred language of the Quran, the language of the great Khalifa and Saladin, the most beautiful and intricate of all human tongues.
Well, it sounds like a raccoon clearing its throat, Lindsay noted. Colin stopped for a moment to ponder that.
I need time to do my work, Colin said, and Hollis just nodded.
Splendid, Lindsay said, seemingly genuine. Splendid, but you can't have my room.
His mouth half full of rice, Hassan said, I think we'll be able to find a place to hunker down somewhere in this house. After a while, Hollis announced,
We should play Scrabble.
Lindsay groaned.
I've never played, Colin said.
A genius who's never played Scrabble? Lindsay asked.
I'm not a genius.
Okay, a smarty pants?
Colin laughed. It suited him. No longer a prodigy, not yet a genius, but still a smarty pants.
I don't play games, Colin said. I don't really play much.
Well, you should. Playing is fun. Although Scrabble isn't really the A number one way of doing it, Lindsay said.
Final score? Hollis, 158. Colin, 521. Lindsay, 293. Hassan, 0.
I'm not playing Scrabble against Singleton. God, if I want to be reminded of how dumb I am, I'll just consult my verbal SAT scores, thanks.
After he called his parents and told them he was in a town called Gutshot, but failed to mention he was boarding with strangers, Colin stayed up late working on the theorem in his new bedroom on the second floor, which featured a nice oak desk with empty drawers. Colin, for whatever reason, had always loved desks with empty drawers. But the theorem didn't go well. He was beginning to worry that he might lack the math expertise for the job when he glanced up to see the bedroom door opening. Lindsay Lee Wells was wearing paisley pajamas.
How's the head?
She asked, sitting down on his bed. He closed his right eye, then opened it, and then pressed a finger against his cut.
It hurts, he responded. Thanks for your treatment, though.
She folded her legs beneath her, smiled, and sang That's What Friends Are For. But then she turned serious, almost shy.
Listen, I wonder if I can just tell you something.
She bit at the inside of her thumb.
Hey, I do that, Colin said, pointing.
Oh, weird. It's like the poor man's thumb-sucking, isn't it? Anyway, I only do it in private, Lindsay said,
and it occurred to Colin that being around him was not really private, but he didn't pursue it.
Right, so anyway, this will sound retarded, but can I just tell you about that picture so you don't think I'm an absolute asshole? Because I've been lying in bed thinking about what an asshole you probably think I am, and how you and Hassan are probably talking about what an asshole I am and everything.
Okay, he said, though frankly he and Hassan had plenty of other things to talk about.
So, I was ugly. I was never fat, really, and I never wore headgear or had zits or anything, but I was ugly. I don't even know how ugly and pretty get decided. Maybe there's like a secret cabal of boys who meet in the locker room and decide who's ugly and who's hot, because as far as I can remember, there was no such thing as a hot fourth grader.
Clearly, you never met Catherine the First, interrupted Colin.
Rule one of stories, no interrupting, but ha-ha, perv. Anyway, I was ugly. I got picked on a lot. I'm not going to bore you with stories about how bad it was, but it was pretty bad. I was miserable. And so, in eighth grade, I went all alternative. Hollis and I drove to Memphis and bought me a whole new wardrobe, and I got me a Zelda haircut and dyed it black and stopped going outside in the sun. And I was like half emo and half goth and half punk and half nerd chic. Basically, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but it didn't matter because the middle school in Milan, Tennessee had never seen emo or goth or punk or nerd chic. I was different, that was all. And I hated all of them, and they hated all of me for an entire year. And then high school started, and I decided to make them like me. I just decided. It was so easy, dude. It was so, so easy. I just became it. If it walks like a cool kid and talks like a cool kid and dresses like a cool kid and has the right mix of naughty and nasty and nice like a cool kid, it becomes a cool kid. But I'm not an asshole to people. There's not even really popularity at my school.
That, said Colin emphatically, is a sentence that has only ever been spoken by popular people.
Well, okay.
but I'm not just some former ugly girl who sold her soul to date hotties and go to the finest keg parties the greater Gutshot area has to offer. She repeated it, almost offensively. I didn't sell my soul.
Okay. I wouldn't care if you did, Colin acknowledged. Nerds always say they don't give a shit about popularity, but not having friends sucks. I never liked quote-unquote cool kids, personally. I thought they were all dumb little shits, but I probably like them in some ways. Like, the other day, I told Hassan I wanted to matter, like, be remembered, and he said, famous is the new popular. Maybe he's right, and maybe I just want to be famous. I was thinking about this tonight, actually, that maybe I want strangers to think I'm cool, since people who actually know me don't. I was at the zoo once when I was 10 on a class trip, and I really needed to pee, right? I actually had repeated urges to urinate that day, probably due to overhydration. Incidentally, did you know that the whole 8 glasses a day thing is complete bullshit and has no scientific basis? So many things are like that. Everyone just assumes they're true because people are basically lazy and incurious, which incidentally is one of those words that sounds like it wouldn't be a word but is.
It's very weird to watch your brain work, Lindsay said, and Colin sighed. He knew he couldn't tell stories, that he always included extraneous details and tangents that interested only him. Anyway, the end of that story is that I came relatively close to having a lion bite off my penis, and my point was that shit like that never happens to popular people, ever. Lindsay laughed. That sounds like a hell of a good story if only you knew how to tell it.
She bit at her thumb again, her private habit. From behind her hand, she said, Well, I think you're cool, and I want you to think I'm cool. And that's all popular is. The end of the beginning. After their first kiss, Colin and Catherine the First sat in silence for perhaps 2 minutes. Catherine watched Colin carefully, and he tried to continue translating Ovid, but he found himself with an unprecedented problem. Colin couldn't focus. He kept glancing up at her. Her big blue eyes, too big for her young face really, stared unceasingly at him. He figured he was in love. Finally, she spoke.
Colin, she said.
Yes, Catherine.
I'm breaking up with you.
At the time, of course, Colin did not fully understand the significance of the moment. He immersed himself in Ovid, grieving his loss in silence. And she continued to watch him for the next half hour, until her parents came into the living room to take her home. But it only took a few more Catherines for him to look back nostalgically upon the Great One as the perfect spokesperson for the Catherine phenomenon. Their 3-minute relationship was the thing itself in its most unadulterated form. It was the immutable tango between the dumper and the dumpy, the coming and the seeing and the conquering and the returning home. Chapter 8. When you spend your entire life in and around the city of Chicago, as it turns out, you fail to fully apprehend certain facets of rural life. Take, for example, the troubling case of the rooster. To Colin's mind, the rooster crowing at dawn was nothing more than a literary and cinematic trope. When an author wanted a character to be awoken at dawn, Colin figured the author just used the literary tradition of the crowing rooster to make it happen. It was, he thought, just like how authors always wrote things in ways other than how they actually happened. Authors never included the whole story. They just got to the point. Colin thought the truth should matter as much as the point, and he figured that was why he couldn't tell good stories. That morning, he learned that roosters really don't start crowing at dawn. They start well before dawn, around 5 a.m., Colin rolled over in the foreign bed, and for a few slow seconds, as he squinted into the darkness, he felt good. Tired and annoyed with the rooster, but good. And then he remembered that she'd dumped him, and he thought of her in her big fluffy bed asleep, not dreaming of him. He rolled over and looked at his cell phone. No missed calls. The rooster crowed again.
Cock-a-doodle don't, motherfucker, Colin mumbled.
But the rooster cockadoodle did, and by dawn, the crowing created a kind of weird dissonant symphony when mingled with the muffled sounds of a Muslim's morning prayers. Those hours of unsleep-throughable loudness allowed him ample time to wonder about everything, from when Catherine last thought of him to the number of grammatically correct anagrams of rooster. He found 40, of which he only really liked two, rose rot and to err so. Around 7 a.m., as the rooster, or perhaps there was more than one, perhaps they crowed in shifts, entered its third hour of shrieking cries, Colin stumbled into the bathroom, which also connected to Hassan's bedroom. Hassan was already in the shower. For all its luxury, their bathroom contained no bathtub.
"Morning, Haas."
"Hey,"
Hassan shouted over the water.
"Dude, Hollis is asleep in the living room watching the Home Shopping Network. She's got a billion-dollar house, and she sleeps on the couch."
"These people are weird," Colin said, pulling out his toothbrush mid-sentence.
"Whatever. Hollis loves me. She thinks I hung the moon. And that you're a genius. And at $500 a week, I'll never have to work again. $500 can last me 5 months at home, dude. I can survive on this summer till I'm like 30.
"Your lack of ambition is truly remarkable." Hassan's hand reached out from behind the shower and grabbed a towel monogrammed HLW. He emerged moments later and walked into Colin's room, towel around his sizable waist.
"Listen, Kafir. Seriously, lay off about me going to school. Let me be happy, and I'll let you be happy. Giving each other shit is fine, but there comes a point."
"Sorry, I didn't know the point had come." Colin sat down on the bed, pulling on a cranial kid's t-shirt he'd been given.
"Well, you've brought it up like 284 consecutive days."
"Maybe we should have a word," Colin said,
"for when it's gone too far. Like, just a random word, and then we'll know to back off."
Standing there in his towel, Hassan looked up at the ceiling and finally said,
"Dingleberries."
"Dingleberries," Colin agreed, anagramming in his head. Dingleberries was an anagrammatic jackpot. See inbred girl. Lie breeds grin. Leering debris. Greed be nil, sir. Be idle, ray rings. Ringside rebel. Residing rebel.
"You're anagramming, aren't you, motherfucker?" asked Hassan.
"Yeah," Colin said.
"Maybe that's why she dumped you. Always anagramming, never listening."
"Dingleberries," said Colin.
"Just wanted to give you a chance to use it. Okay, let's go eat. I'm hungrier than a kid on his third day of fat camp."
As they made their way down a hall to a spiral staircase that led to the living room, Colin asked, as close to a whisper as he could muster,
"So why do you think Hollis wants to give us jobs, really?"
Hassan stopped on the staircase and Colin with him.
"She wants to make me happy. We fatties have a bond, dude. It's like a secret society. We've got all kinds of shit you don't know about. Handshakes, special fat people dances. We got these secret fugging lairs in the center of the earth, and we go down there in the middle of the night when all the skinny kids are sleeping and eat cake and fried chicken and shit. Why do you think Hollis is still sleeping, Kafir? Because we were up all night in the secret lair, injecting butter frosting into our veins. She's giving us jobs because a fatty always trusts another fatty. You're not fat, you're pudgy. Dude, you just saw my man tits when I got out of the shower."
"They're not that bad," said Colin.
"Oh, that's it. You asked for it."
Hassan pulled his t-shirt up to his collarbone, and Colin glanced over at Haas's hairy chest, which featured, okay, there's no denying it, minor breasts. An A cup, but still. Hassan smiled with great satisfaction, pulled down his shirt, and headed down the stairs. It took an hour for Hollis to get ready, during which time Hassan and Lindsay chatted and watched the Today Show, while Colin sat at the far edge of the couch and read one of the books he'd stuffed in his backpack, a Lord Byron anthology, including the poems Lara and Don Juan. He liked it pretty well. When Lindsay interrupted him, he'd just come to a line in Lara he liked quite a lot. "Eternity bids thee to forget."
"What you reading there, smarty pants?" asked Lindsay.
Colin held up the cover.
"Don Juan," she said, "trying to learn how to avoid getting dumped."
"Juan," Colin corrected. "It's pronounced Don Juan," he said. "That's true. Much of the meter in Don Juan only works if you read Juan as bisyllabic."
"Not interesting," Hassan pointed out,
but Lindsay seemed to find it more aggravating than not interesting. She rolled her eyes and picked up the breakfast plates from the coffee table. Hollis Wells came downstairs wrapped in what looked for all the world like a flowery toga.
"What we're doing," she spoke quickly, "is we're putting together an oral history of Gutshot for future generations. I've been pulling people off the line to do interviews for a couple of weeks, but I ain't got it now that you're here. Anyway, the downfall of this whole operation so far has been gossip. Everybody chattering about what everyone else says or doesn't say, but y'all don't have a reason in the world to talk about whether or not Ellie Mae liked her husband when she married him in 1937. So it's you two and Linz, who everybody trusts."
"I'm very honest," Lindsay explained, cutting off her mom.
"To a fault, dear, but yes. So you get these people talking and they won't shut up, I assure you. I want 6 hours of new tape turned in to me every day. But steer them toward real history if you can. I'm doing this for my grandkids, not for a gossip fest."
Lindsay coughed, mumbled, "Bullshit," and then coughed again. Hollis's eyes grew wide.
"Lindsay Lee Wells, you put a quarter in the swear jar right this minute."
"Shit," Lindsay said. "Dick, craptastic." She glided over to the fireplace mantel and placed a dollar bill in a glass mason jar.
"Don't have any change, Hollis," she said.
Colin couldn't help but laugh. Hollis glowered.
"Well," she said, "y'all should head out. 6 hours of tape and be back by supper."
"Wait, who's going to open up the store?" asked Lindsay.
"I'll just send Colin out there for a while."
"I'm supposed to be tape recording strangers," Colin pointed out.
"The other Colin," Hollis said. "Lindsay's boyfriend. He hasn't been showing up at work half the time anyway. Now y'all get."
In the hearse, with Hassan driving down the exceedingly long driveway away from the Pink Mansion, Lindsay said,
"Lindsay's boyfriend. It's always Lindsay's boyfriend. Jesus Christ. Anyway, listen, just drop me off at the store."
Hassan looked up and spoke to Lindsay through the rearview mirror.
"No fucking way. That's how horror movies start. We drop you off, walk into some stranger's home, and 5 minutes later, some psycho's lobbing off my nuts with a machete while his schizophrenic wife makes Colin do push-ups on a bed of hot coals. You're coming with us."
"No offense to y'all, but I haven't seen Colin since yesterday."
"No offense to that fugger," Hassan responded, "but Colin is sitting in the passenger seat reading Don Juan. You're dating the other Colin, a.k.a. Tuck."
Colin wasn't reading anymore. He was listening to Hassan defend him. Or at least he thought Hassan was defending him. You could never quite tell with Hassan.
"I mean, my boy over here is clearly the primary Colin. There's no one like him. Colin, say unique in as many languages as you can."
Colin brought them forth quickly. This was a word he knew.
Unico, Spanish. Unico, Italian. Einzigartig, German. Unique, French. Unique, English. Muahakis, Greek. Singularis, Latin. Farid, Arabic.
Hassan was good at his job, no doubt. Colin felt a rush of affection toward him, and the recitation of the words caused something to wash over the omnipresent hole in his gut. It felt, just for a moment, like medicine. Lindsay smiled at Colin through the rearview mirror.
"Lord, my cup of Colin's runneth over."
She smiled.
"One to teach me French, one to French me."
She laughed at her own joke, then said,
"Well, okay, I'll go. I wouldn't want to see Colin get his nuts chopped off after all."
"Either Colin, really. But you gotta take me to the store after."
Hassan agreed, and then Lindsay led them down past what she called the Taco Hell to a little side street lined with small, single-story houses. They pulled into a driveway.
"Most people are at work," she explained, "but Starnes should be home."
He greeted them at the door. Starnes' lower jaw was missing. He appeared to have a kind of duck bill covered in skin instead of a chin or jaw or teeth. And yet he still tried to smile for Lindsay.
"Sugar," he said. "How are you?"
"I'm always good when I get to see you, Starnes," she said, hugging him.
His eyes lit up, and then Lindsay introduced him to Colin and Hassan. When the old man noticed Colin staring, Starnes explained,
"Cantler, now y'all come in and sit."
The house smelled like musty old couches and unfinished wood. It smelled, Colin thought, like cobwebs or hazy memories. It smelled like K-19's basement.
and the smell brought him back so viscerally to a time when she loved him, or at least he felt like she did, that his gut ached anew. He closed his eyes tight for a second and waited for the feeling to pass, but it wouldn't. For Colin, nothing ever passed.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please continue listening on disc number 3. This is disc number 3.
The house smelled like musty old couches and unfinished wood. It smelled, Colin thought, like cobwebs or hazy memories. It smelled like K-19's basement. And the smell brought him back so viscerally to a time when she loved him, or at least he felt like she did, that his gut ached anew. He closed his eyes tight for a second and waited for the feeling to pass, but it wouldn't. For Colin, nothing ever passed. The beginning of the end. Catherine the 19th wasn't quite yet the 19th when they hung out alone together for the third time. Although the signs seemed positive, he couldn't bring himself to ask her if she wanted to date him, and he certainly couldn't just lean in and kiss her. Colin frequently faltered when it came to the step of actual kissing. He had a theory on this subject, actually, entitled the Rejection Minimization Theorem, RMT. The act of leaning in to kiss someone, or asking to kiss them, is fraught with the possibility of rejection. So the person least likely to get rejected should do the leaning in or the asking. And that person, at least in high school heterosexual relationships, is definitely the girl. Think about it. Boys basically want to kiss girls. Guys want to make out, always. Hassan aside, there's rarely a time when a boy is thinking, I'd rather not kiss a girl today. Maybe if a guy is actually literally on fire, he won't be thinking about hooking up. But that's about it. Whereas girls are very fickle about the business of kissing. Sometimes they want to make out, sometimes they don't. They're an impenetrable fortress of unknowability, really. Ergo, girls should always make the first move because A, they are on the whole less likely to be rejected than guys, and B, that way, girls will never get kissed unless they want to be kissed. Unfortunately for Colin, there is nothing logical about kissing, and so his theory never worked. But because he always waited so incredibly long to kiss a girl, he rarely faced rejection. He called the future Catherine the 19th that Friday after school and asked her out for coffee the next day, and she said yes. It was the same coffee shop where they'd had their first two meetings, perfectly pleasant events filled with so much sexual tension that he couldn't help but get a little bit turned on just from her casually touching his hand. He would put his hands up on the table, in fact, because he wanted them within her reach. The coffee shop was a few miles from Catherine's house and four buildings down from Colin's. Called Café Selle Marie, it served some of the best coffee in Chicago, which didn't matter at all to Colin because Colin didn't like coffee. He liked the idea of coffee quite a lot, a warm drink that gave you energy, and had been for centuries associated with sophisticates and intellectuals. But coffee itself tasted to him like caffeinated stomach bile. So he did an end-around on the unfortunate taste by drowning his Java in cream, for which Catherine gently teased him that afternoon. It rather goes without saying that Catherine drank her coffee black. Catherines do, generally. They like their coffee like they like their ex-boyfriends. Bitter. Hours later, after four cups of coffee between them, she wanted to show him a movie. "It's called The Royal Tenenbaums," she said, "and it's about a family of prodigies." Colin and Catherine took the Brown Line southeast toward Wrigleyville and then walked 5 blocks to her house, a narrow two-story building. Catherine led him down to her basement. Floored with wavy linoleum tiles, the damp, dank place featured an old couch, no windows, and very low ceilings. They were 6'3" to Colin's 6'1". It made for a poor living area, but it was an awesome theater. It was so dark that you could sink into the couch and disappear into the movie. Colin liked the movie pretty well. He laughed a lot, anyway. And he found comfort in a world where all the characters who had been smart children grew up to be really fascinating, unique adults, even if they were all screwed up. When it was over, Catherine and Colin sat in the dark together,
The basement was the only genuinely dark place Colin had ever seen in Chicago. Day and night, orange-gray light seeped through any place with windows.
"I just love the soundtrack," Catherine said. "It has such a cool feel."
"Yeah," Colin said, "and I liked the characters. I even liked the horrible dad a little."
"Right, me too," Catherine said.
He could see her blonde hair and the outline of her face, but little else. His hand, which had been holding hers since about 30 minutes into the movie, was cramped and sweaty, but he didn't want to be the one to pull away. She went on.
"I mean, he's selfish, but everyone is selfish."
"Right," Colin said.
"So, is that what it's like? To be a prodigy or whatever?"
Not really. All the prodigies in the movie were really hot, for instance, he joked, and she laughed and said,
"So are all the ones I know."
And then he exhaled sharply and looked up at her and almost, but no. He wasn't sure and couldn't handle the thought of rejection. Anyway, plus in the movie, it's like they're all just born talented. I'm not like that, you know. I mean, I've worked at least 10 hours a day, every day since I was 3, he said with no small measure of pride. He did think of it as work. The reading and the practicing of languages and pronunciation, the recitation of facts, the careful examination of every text laid before him.
"So what are you good at, exactly, anyway? I mean, I know you're good at everything, but what are you so good at besides languages?"
"I'm good with codes and stuff. And I'm good at, like, linguistic tricks, like anagramming.
That's my favorite thing, really. I can anagram anything."
He'd never before told a Catherine about his anagramming. He always figured it would bore them.
"Anything?"
"Night, nay," he answered quickly, and she laughed and then said,
"Catherine Carter."
He wanted so much to put his hand around the nape of her neck and pull her into him and taste her mouth, full and soft in the darkness. But not yet. He wasn't sure. His heart pounded. Okay. Her Karate Cretan. I like this one. Their Arcane Trek. She laughed and pulled her hand away and placed it flat against his knee. Her fingers were soft. He could suddenly smell her over the dank basement. She smelled like lilacs. And then he knew that it was almost time, but he didn't dare look at her. Not yet. He just watched the blank TV screen. He wanted to draw out the moment before the moment, because as good as kissing feels, nothing feels as good as the anticipation of it.
"How do you do that?" she asked.
"Practice, mostly. I've been doing it a long time. I see the letters and pull out a good word first, like karate or arcane, and then I try to use the remaining letters to make..." "Oh, God, this is boring," he said, hoping it wasn't.
"No, it's not. I just try to make grammatical sense with the remaining letters. Anyway, it's just a trick."
"Okay, so anagrams, that's one. Got any other charming talents?" she asked, and now he felt confident. Finally, Colin turned to her, gathering in his gut the slim measure of courage available to him, and said, "Well, I'm a fair kisser." Chapter 9.
"Y'all make yourselves at home. Hollis said you mightn't come over here to interview me and find out all about my fascinating life,"
Starnes said, and Colin sat down on a musty couch, not unlike the one on which he and K-19 had shared their first kiss. Lindsay introduced Colin and Hassan, and then Colin started asking questions. The room was not air-conditioned, and as Colin pressed the record button of the digital mini-recorder and placed it on Starnes's coffee table, he felt the first bead of sweat form on his neck. It would be a long day.
"When did you come to Gutshot?" Lindsay asked.
"I was born in the country 1920.
It eventually became clear to Colin that by country, Starnes did not mean the United States of America, but rather this general area of south-central Tennessee.
"Born here, raised up here, always lived here, and gonna die here, I'm sure," he said,
and then winked at Lindsay.
"Aw, Starnes, don't say that," Lindsay said. "What the hell would I do round here without you?"
"Probably run around with that Lyford boy,"
Starnes answered. Starnes turned to the boys and then said,
"I don't think too highly of that boy's daddy."
"You just want me all to yourself," Lindsay said, laughing.
Tell us about the factory, Starnes. These boys ain't ever been.
Around Starnes, for some reason, Lindsay spoke with a thick accent.
The factory opened up 3 years before I was born, and I worked there from when I was 14. I suppose if I hadn't, I would have farmed. That's what my father did until the factory came along. We made everything back then, T-shirts and handkerchiefs and bandanas, and it was hard work. But your family was always fair. First Dr. Dinsenfar, and then his son-in-law, Corville Wells. Then there was that sumbitch Alex, who I know was your daddy, Lindsay, so you'll have to forgive me. And then Hollis, who took good care of us every one. I worked in that factory 60 years to the day. I have the world record. They named the break room after me, because that's where I spent most of my time.
His upper lip smiled, but Starnes's jawless chin couldn't follow suit. Already, the house felt like a hot tub without the water and bubbles. This is a hard way to make $100, Colin thought.
Y'all want some tea?
Starnes asked. Without waiting for an answer, he stood up and walked into the kitchen. At once sweet and bitter, it tasted a little like lemonade, except somehow more grown up. Colin loved it. It was everything he'd hoped coffee would be, and helped himself to several glasses while Starnes talked, pausing only to take his medication once and go to the bathroom 4 times. Old people do that. They seem to love bathrooms.
Well, the first thing you have to understand is that in the country, we weren't ever poor. Even in the Depression, I wasn't ever hungry, because when Dr. Dinsenfar had to lay people off, he never fired more than one person from a family.
Something about Dr. Dinsenfar led Starnes elsewhere.
You know, they've been calling the country Gutshot for a long-ass time, and Lindsay, I bet you don't even know why.
Lindsay shook her head politely, and Starnes leaned forward out of his lazy boy and said,
"Aw, see, now y'all haven't heard a damn thing about the place then. Back in the old days, so old that even this old man weren't born yet, prize-fighting was illegal, and if you wanted to break the law, Gutshot was a fine place to do it. Always has been, really. I saw the inside of the Carver County Jail a few times myself, you know. I was drunk in public in 1948, I was a public nuisance in 1956, and then I was in jail for 2 days on illegal discharging of a firearm when I killed Caroline Clayton's rat snake in 1974. Mary wouldn't bail me out after I killed that godforsaken snake, you know. But how on earth am I supposed to tell it's a pet? I go into Caroline Clayton's house looking for the hammer she borrowed from me 6 months before, and there's a by-God rat snake slithering across the kitchen. What would you do, son?
He asked Colin. Colin mulled the situation over.
You went into someone else's house without knocking? He asked.
No, I knocked, but she wasn't to home.
That's a crime also, Colin pointed out. Trespassing.
Well, thank the Lord you didn't arrest me, boy. Starnes said. Anyway, you see a snake, you kill it. That's just how I was raised up, so I shot it. Split it right in two. And that evening, Caroline Clayton come over to my house. She's passed on now, bless her heart. And she's screaming and crying that I killed Jake. And I told her that someone else must have killed Jake, whoever the hell he was, because all I did was shoot up a goddamn rat snake. But then turns out that Jake was the snake, and that she loved it like the child she never had. She never married, of course. Uglier and thin, bless her heart.
The snake probably didn't care that she was ugly, Colin pointed out. They have very poor eyesight. Starnes looked over at Lindsay Lee Wells.
Your friend here is a regular fountain of knowledge.
He sure God is, she said, drawling.
What was I talking about?
Asked Starnes.
Gutshot, boxing, the old days?
Colin answered quickly.
Right, yes. Well, it was a town for trouble back then, before the factory brought in families. Just a rough sharecropper town. My mama told me the town didn't have no name, but then they started bringing in boxers. Boys from all over the country would come here and they'd fight for $5 or $10, winner take all, and make extra money betting on themselves. But to get around the prize-fighting laws, they had this rule. You couldn't hit below the belt or above the shoulders. Gut-shot boxing. The town became famous for it, and that's what we got called.
Colin wiped the back of his sweaty palm against his sweaty forehead, spreading the moisture around rather than truly dealing with it, and took several gulps of tea.
Mary and I got married in 1944, Starnes went on, when I was supposed to go off to the war.
And Colin thought that Starnes might benefit from a lesson from his 11th grade English teacher, Mr. Holtzclaw, who taught them about transitions. Colin couldn't tell a story to save his life, admittedly, but at least he'd heard of transitions. Still, it was fun to listen to Starnes.
Anyway, I didn't go off to the war because I shot off two of my toes because I'm a coward. I'm an old man, so I can tell you that frankly. I wasn't afraid of war, you know. War never scared me. I just didn't want to go all the way hell over there to fight one. I had a reputation after that. I pretended I shot myself by accident, but everyone knew. I never did lose that reputation, but now most everyone is dead, and y'all ain't got any stories from them, so you have to believe mine by default. They were cowards, too, everyone is. But we got married, and oh, Lord, we sure loved each other. Always did, till the very end. She never liked me much, but she sure loved me, if you know what I'm saying.
Colin glanced at Hassan, who glanced back, his eyes wide in horror. They both feared they knew exactly what Starnes was saying.
She died in 1997, heart attack. She was nothing but good, and I was nothing but bad. But then she died, and I didn't.
He showed them pictures then. They crowded around his lazy boy as his wrinkled hands flipped slowly through a photo album thick with memories. The oldest pictures were faded and yellowing, and Colin thought about how, even in pictures of their youth, old people look old. He watched as the pictures moved to a crisp black and white and then to the bland color of Polaroids, watched as children were born and then grew up, as hair fell out and was replaced by wrinkles. And all the while, Starnes and Mary stayed in the pictures together, from their wedding to their 50th anniversary. I will have that, Colin thought. I will have it. I will. With Catherine. But I won't be only that, he resolved. I will leave behind something more than one photo album where I always look old. Later, Colin knew their 6 hours were up when Lindsay Lee Wells stood up and said,
Well, we gotta get going, Starnes.
All right, he said. Good to have you. And Lindsay, you just look perfect.
You need an air conditioner, bud. It's awful hot in here, and Hollis could get you one no problem, Lindsay said.
I get by all right. She's done good by me.
Starnes stood up and walked them to the door. Colin shook the old man's shaky hand. In the hearse, Colin drove as fast as the roads would permit, with the windows down, trying to cool off. Hassan said,
I think I just lost 60 pounds in sweat.
Then you could stand to stay out in the heat a while longer, Lindsay said. That was the easiest $100 anyone ever made in Gutshot. Hey, no, don't turn. I need you to take me to the store.
So we can all hang out with the other Colin in the sweet, sweet air conditioning?
Lindsay shook her head. Uh-uh.
You get to drop me off, and then you make yourself scarce till you pick me up in 2 hours, and then we tell Hollis that we spent the afternoon running around the country.
Well, said Hassan, sounding somewhat annoyed, we will certainly miss your abundant charm and bubbly personality.
Oh, I'm sorry, she said. I'm just kidding around. Anyway, I like you, Hassan. It's the smarty pants I find unbearable.
Colin glanced through the rear view into the back seat. She was smiling at him with her lips closed. He knew she was kidding, or thought she was, but he still felt anger rise up in his throat, and he knew the hurt was betrayed in his eyes.
Jesus, Singleton, I'm just kidding.
You've got to remember that usually when he hears a girl call him unbearable, it's the last words of a Catherine, explained Hassan,
talking like Colin wasn't behind the wheel.
He's pretty touchy on the whole subject of his being unbearable.
Dingleberries, said Colin.
Gotcha.
After dropping off Lindsay, they ended up back at Hardee's, eating a mid-afternoon snack of double cheeseburgers and fries limp with the weight of their own grease. Colin read from Byron for the first 30 minutes, while Hassan repeatedly sighed and said,
God, you're boring,
until finally Colin put the book down. They still had an hour to kill when the meal was over. Standing in the parking lot with the heat radiating in waves off the pavement, Hassan wiped his forehead and said,
"I think we should stop by the Gutshot General Store."
They pulled into the store's dirt parking lot 50 minutes early and strode up the staircase into a blast of air conditioning. Behind the counter, Lindsay Lee Wells was sitting on what appeared to be a boy who had an arm draped across her lap.
"Hello," said Colin.
Talk peeked out from behind Lindsay. He nodded at Colin without smiling or blinking or in any way moving any of the muscles in his strong, round face.
"What's up?" said Talk.
"Not much," said Colin.
"You're a lucky couple of guys to get to live with Lindsay."
Lindsay let loose a chirpy laugh and contorted herself to kiss her boyfriend sweetly on the neck.
"Oh, we'll live together one day," she said.
"If you touch her," Talk said out of the blue, "I'll kill you."
"That's a little cliched," Hassan called out from the candy aisle. "And if we touch her? I mean, what if I brush up against her as we walk through a hallway?"
Talk glowered.
"Well," he said, "this has been fun, but Lindsay and I were in the middle of a very important talk, so if you wouldn't mind..."
To diffuse the tension, Colin said, "Oh, sorry, yeah, we'll just, take a walk or something."
"Here,"
Lindsay said, and tossed them a set of keys.
"Colin's truck has AC."
"Don't take that truck out of park," Talk said gruffly.
As they walked out the door, Colin heard Talk ask Lindsay,
"Who's the genius, the fat one or the skinny one?"
But he didn't hang around to hear Lindsay's response. As they walked across the dirt parking lot toward Talk's SUV, Hassan said,
"God, he's built like a brick shithouse, isn't he? Listen, the fat one's going to take a piss in the field."
"The skinny one will wait for the fat one in the truck," Colin said.
Colin climbed in, turned the key, and put the AC on full blast, although at first it only pumped out hot air. Hassan opened the passenger door and immediately started talking.
"She's so bubbly around him, but then around us she's just one of the guys, just slinging shit, and then around Starn she was all yawling it up and talking southern."
"Do you have a crush on her or something?" asked Colin suddenly.
"No, I was just thinking aloud. For the last time, I'm not interested in dating a girl I'm not gonna marry. Dating Lindsay would be haram. Also, she's got a big nose. I don't go in for noses."
Haram is an Arabic word that means forbidden by Islam.
"Well, not to start an argument, but you do all kinds of shit that is haram."
Hassan nodded.
"But the haram shit I do is like having a dog. It's not like smoking crack or talking behind people's backs or stealing or lying to my mom or fucking girls."
"Moral relativism," Colin said.
"No, it's not. I don't think God gives a shit if we have a dog or if a woman wears shorts. I think he gives a shit about whether you're a good person."
The words "good person" made Colin immediately think about Catherine the 19th. She would be leaving Chicago soon for a camp in Wisconsin, where she worked every summer as a counselor. The camp was for kids with physical disabilities. They taught them how to ride horses. She was such a good person, and he missed her all over his body. He missed her like crazy cakes. It's cheesy, but that's what they always said to each other. "I love you like crazy cakes, I miss you like crazy cakes," etc. But he felt, in the throbbing missing piece inside him, that she didn't long for him like that. She was probably relieved. If she were thinking of him, she'd call. Unless... "I think I'm going to call her."
"That's the worst idea you've ever had," Hassan replied immediately. "The worst idea ever."
"No, it's not, because what if she's just waiting for me to call like I'm waiting for her to call?"
"Right, but you're the dumpy. Dumpies don't call. You know that, Kafir. Dumpies must never, never call. There's no exception to that rule. None. Never call. Never. You can't call."
Colin reached into his pocket.
"Don't do it, dude. You're pulling the pin on a grenade. You're covered in gasoline and the phone is a lit match."
Colin flipped open the phone. "Dingleberries," he said. Hassan threw up his hands.
"You can't dingleberry that. That's a flagrant misuse of the dingleberry. I dingleberry you calling her."
Colin closed the phone and mulled it over. Pensive, he bit at the inside of his thumb.
"Okay," he said, sliding the phone back into his pocket. "I won't."
Hassan sighed heavily.
That was a close one. Thank goodness for the double reverse dingleberry.
They sat in silence for a moment, and then Colin said, I want to go home.
To Chicago?
No, to Lindsay's, but we still have 40 minutes to kill. Hassan stared out through the windshield and nodded his head slowly. After a few quiet moments, he said,
Okay. Okay, fat kid asthma attack. It's an oldie, but it's a goodie.
What? Hassan rolled his eyes.
What are you, deaf? Fat kid asthma attack. It's the oldest trick in the whole fat kid book. Just follow my lead.
They got out of the car, and Hassan started wheezing very loudly. His every inhalation sounded like the cry of a dying duck. Exhale. Exhale. He placed his hand against his chest and ran into the Gutshot General store.
What's wrong with him? Lindsay asked Colin.
Before he could answer, Hassan started talking amid his wheezes.
Asthma. Attack. Bad one.
Oh, shit, said Lindsay.
She hopped off Tok's lap, turned around, grabbed her first aid box, and started looking through it in vain for asthma meds. The other Colin sat silently on the stool, no doubt displeased by the interruption.
He'll be fine, Colin said. It happens. I just need to get him home to his inhaler. Hollis doesn't like it when people show up when she's working, Lindsay said.
Well, she'll make an exception, said Colin. Hassan kept up his wheezing for the drive home, and as he raced up the Pink Mansion's stairs to his room, Colin sat with Lindsay in the living room. They could both hear Hollis in the kitchen saying,
This is an American product. It's made with American labor. That's a selling point. That's a marketable, promotable facet of our product. People buy American. I've got a study here.
Colin had wondered whether maybe Hollis just watched the Home Shopping Network all day and left other people to run the business, but obviously she did work. Hollis came out then, and the first thing she said was,
Please don't interrupt me during working hours.
And then Lindsay said Hassan had an asthma attack and forgot his inhaler, and then Hollis took off running up the stairs. Colin followed, quickly shouting,
I hope you're okay, Hassan,
so that Hassan would know she was coming, and when they all got to his room, he was lying peacefully on the bed.
Sorry, I forgot my inhaler, he said. It won't happen again.
They ate a dinner of hamburgers and steamed asparagus in the Wells family backyard. Colin's backyard in Chicago measured 12 feet by 10 feet. This backyard went on for football fields. To their left, a hill rose to its peak, the forest broken up only by a few rocky outcroppings. To their right, a well-kept lawn stretched on down the hill toward a soybean field. He'd found out from Starnes that they were soybeans. As the sun set behind them, a citronella candle burned in a bucket in the center of the table to ward off mosquitoes. Colin liked how Gutshot felt wide open and endless. When he finished eating, Colin's mind returned to Catherine the 19th. He glanced at his phone to see if she'd called and noticed it was time to call his parents. For whatever reason, Colin could never get reception in his house in the third largest city in America, but had all 5 bars in Gutshot, Tennessee. His father picked up.
I'm still in the same town as yesterday, Gutshot, Tennessee, Colin began. I'm staying with a woman named Hollis Wells.
Thank you for calling on time. Should that name be familiar to me?
Asked his dad.
No, but she's listed in the phone book, I checked. She owns a factory here. I think we're going to stay here a few days, Colin said, fibbing. Inexplicably, Hassan loves it here, and also we seem to have gotten jobs.
You can't just stay with strangers, Colin.
Colin considered lying. Staying in a hotel, working in a restaurant here, getting my bearings. But he told the truth. She's nice. I trust her.
You trust everyone.
Dad, I survived 17 years in Chicago without ever getting mugged or stabbed or kidnapped or falling on the third rail or get...
Talk to your mother,
he said, which is what his dad always said. After a few moments, Colin could just see them talking while his dad held his hand over the receiver. His mom picked up.
Well, are you happy?
I wouldn't go that far.
Happier?
His mom tried. Marginally, he allowed. I'm not lying face down on the carpet.
Let me talk to this woman,
his mom said. So Colin walked inside, found Hollis on the couch, and handed the phone to her.
and after talking to Hollis, it was decided he could stay. He knew that his mom wanted him to have an adventure. She'd always wished he could be a normal kid. Colin suspected she'd be secretly pleased if he came home one night at 3 in the morning reeking of booze, because that would be normal. Normal kids come home late. Normal kids drink warm 40s of malt liquor in alleys with their friends. Normal kids have more than one friend. His father wanted Colin to transcend all that stuff, but maybe even he was starting to see the unlikelihood of Colin ever becoming extraordinary. Colin walked up to Hassan's room to tell him his parents were cool with him staying, but Hassan wasn't home. He hunted around the cavernous house, eventually making his way downstairs, where he found a closed door with Lindsay's voice emanating from behind it. He stood in front of the thin door and listened.
"Right, but how does he do it? Does he just memorize everything?"
Lindsay was saying.
"No, it's not like that. It's like if you or me sat down and read a book about, say, the presidents, and we read that William Howard Taft was the fattest president and one time he got stuck in a bathtub."
Which is true.
"That might click in our brains as interesting and we'd remember it, right?"
Lindsay laughed.
"You and me read a book and find, like, 3 interesting things that we remember. But Colin finds everything intriguing. He reads a book about presidents, and he remembers more of it, because everything he reads clicks in his head as fucking interesting. Honestly, I've seen him do it with the phone book. He'll be like, 'Oh, there are 24 listings for Tischler. How fascinating!'"
Colin felt an odd mix of feelings, like his talent was at once being inflated and ridiculed. It was true, he guessed. But it wasn't just that he found things fascinating in and of themselves and could memorize the whole phone book because it made for such excellent literature. He found stuff fascinating for a reason. Like, take for example the Tischler thing, which happened to be true, and Hassan remembered it correctly. Tischler was the German word for carpenter. And when he was looking in the phone book that day with Hassan, Colin thought, how strange that there would be exactly 24 German carpenters in Chicago when the all-night manicure place on the corner of Oakley and Lawrence is called 24/7 Nails. And then he got to wondering whether there were exactly 7 carpenters of some other language in the Chicago phone book. And it turned out that there were precisely 7 carpinteros. So it wasn't just that things interested him because he didn't know from boring. It was the connection his brain made, connections he couldn't help but seek out.
"But that doesn't explain why he's good at, like, Scrabble," Lindsay pointed out. "Right, well, he's good at that because he's ridiculously good at anagramming. But anything he takes up, he just works insanely hard. Like typing. He didn't learn to type until 9th grade when we were friends. Our English teacher required typewritten papers, so over, like, 2 weeks, Singleton taught himself to type. And he didn't do it by typing his English papers, because then he wouldn't have been good enough at typing. What he did is, he sat down at his computer every day after school and retyped Shakespeare's plays. All of them, literally. And then he retyped The Catcher in the Rye, and he kept retyping and retyping until he could fucking type like a genius."
Colin backed away from the door then. It occurred to him that he'd never done anything else in his whole life. Anagramming. Spitting back facts he'd learned in books. Memorizing 99 digits of an already known number. Falling in love with the same 9 letters over and over again. Retyping and retyping and retyping and retyping. His only hope for originality was the theorem. Colin opened the door and found Hassan and Lindsay sitting on opposite sides of a green leather couch in a room dominated by a pool table with pink felt. They were watching poker on a huge flat-screen TV hanging on the wall. Hassan turned around to face Colin.
"Dude," he said, "you can see all their zits."
Colin sat down between them. Lindsay and Hassan talked about poker and zits and HD and DVR while Colin graphed his past. By the end of the night, a slightly tweaked formula had worked for 2 more Ks, 9th and 14th. He barely registered the change when they turned off the TV and started playing pool. He just kept scribbling. He loved the scratching of pencil against paper when he was this focused. It meant something was happening. When the clock read midnight, Colin put his pencil down. He looked up at Lindsay, who was standing on 1 foot, bent over the pool table at an absurdly awkward angle. Hassan seemed to have left the room.
"Hey," said Colin. Oh, you're out of the Twilight Zone, she said. How's the theorem?
Okay, I don't really know if it will work yet. Where's Hassan?
He went to bed.
I asked you if you wanted to play, but I don't think you heard me, so I figured I'd just play against myself for a while.
I'm beating me pretty handily.
Colin stood up and sniffed. I think I'm allergic to this house.
It could be Princess, Lindsay said. This is actually Princess's room.
Shh, she's sleeping.
Colin followed Lindsay to the pool table and knelt down beside her. Beneath the table, a large sphere that initially seemed to be a ball of shaggy carpet grew and then shrunk rhythmically, breathing.
She's always sleeping.
I'm allergic to pet dander, Colin announced. She smirked.
Yeah, well, Princess lived here first.
She sat back down with him, her legs tucked beneath her so that she seemed taller than Colin.
Hassan told me you're good at anagramming, she said.
Yeah, Colin answered. Good at anagramming. Dragon maggot mania.
Lindsay's hand, she'd painted her fingernails in electric blue since yesterday, was suddenly against his forearm, and Colin tensed up from surprise. When he turned his head to look at her, she placed her hand back in her lap.
So, she went on, you're a genius at making words out of other words, but you can't make new words out of thin air.
And yes, again, that was it exactly. A retyper, not a writer. A prodigy, and not a genius. It was so quiet that he could hear Princess breathing, and he felt the missing piece inside him.
I just want to do something that matters, or be something that matters. I just want to matter.
Lindsay didn't answer right away, but she leaned in toward Colin, and he could smell her fruity perfume. And then she laid down next to him on her back, the crown of her head just brushing against his shorts.
I think we're opposites, you and me, she said finally. Because, personally, I think mattering is a piss-poor idea. I just want to fly under the radar, because when you start to make yourself into a big deal, that's when you get shot down. The bigger a deal you are, the worse your life is. Look at, like, the miserable lives of famous people.
Is that why you read Celebrity Living? Lindsay nodded.
Yeah, totally. There's a word in German for it. God, it's on the tip of...
Schadenfreude, Colin said. Finding pleasure in others' pain.
Right. So anyway, Lindsay went on, take staying here. Hollis always tells me that nothing really good will ever happen to me if I stay in Gutshot. And maybe that's true, but nothing really bad will ever happen either, and I'll take that bargain any day.
Colin didn't answer, but he was thinking that Lindsay Lee Wells, for all her coolness and whatever, was a bit of a wimp. But before he could figure a way to say so, Lindsay sat up, animated by a new topic.
Okay, she said, here's the thing about storytelling. You need a beginning and a middle and an end. Your stories have no plots. They're like, here's something I was thinking, and then the next thing I was thinking, and then etc. You can't get away with rambling. You're Colin Singleton, beginning storyteller, so you've got to stick to a straight plot. And you need a good strong moral, or a theme, or whatever. And the other thing is romance and adventure. You've got to put some of those in. If it's a story about peeing into a lion's cage, give yourself a girlfriend who notices how gigantic your winky is, and then saves you from the lion at the last second by tackling you, because she's desperate to save that gorgeous, ginormous winky.
Colin blushed, but Lindsay kept going.
In the beginning, you need to pee. In the middle, you do. In the end, through romance and adventure, your winky is saved from the jaws of a hungry lion, by the pluck of a young girl motivated by her abiding love for giant winkies. And the moral of the story is that a heroic girlfriend combined with a giant winky will save you from even the most desperate situations.
When Colin finished laughing, he placed his hand on top of Lindsay's. It stayed there for a moment, and he could feel the worn place on her thumb where she nibbled at it. He pulled his hand away after a moment and said, my theorem will tell the story. Each graph with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
There's no romance in geometry, Lindsay answered.
Just you wait.
The beginning of the middle.
He never thought much about Catherine the First. He only felt upset about the breakup because that's what you're supposed to feel. Little kids play house, they play war, they play relationships.
I want to go with you. You dumped me. I'm sad. But none of it was really real. Because Catherine's dad was Colin's tutor, Colin and Catherine continued to see each other periodically over the next several years. They got along well, but